Welcome, everyone. Glad you joined us again for another Basic Conversation. Father Basic, we're doing it again. What do you think?
We are. I enjoy them, Brad. Let's go for it.
So this season three, we are focusing on theologians that you've selected that have made a significant impact in the Catholic Church, society, and even for you personally. And for this third episode of this season, we're talking about Martin Buber. What do we need to talk about as far as background and some lead up? Well,
first of all, he's a Jewish philosopher. That would be important. Mm-hmm. So our series here tries to broaden out. We're going to do one on Gandhi along the line and Catholics and Protestants and so on. So we get a variety of people. But Martin Buber is an extremely important figure in the whole religious theological world, and mostly for his work on what we call encouraging the life of dialogue. And his classic work is called I, Thou. And so Martin Buber, we should say, one of the important things in his life happened when he was 3 years old. His mother left him, disappeared, never saw her. And he didn't. He kept thinking she'd come back, and I think it was a babysitter later on told him, your mother isn't coming back. And it was like a shock of realization. This is the reality. My mother's not coming back. I think another important relationship for him was his wife, Paula. She was a Catholic, and she converted to Judaism and lived out the Jewish faith and was a great support. She was a brilliant woman herself. And was a great support to Martin Buber. He died in 1965 to sort of locate him historically. Very connected in with what we call the Zionist movement. So at the turn of the century, there was all kind of talk about restoring a land for Judaism, so the Jews would have their own country, their own place. And it was called the Zionist movement. And Martin Buber saw it as more like a religious cultural thing. Interestingly enough, he was in favor of a one-state solution where Jews and Arabs would live closely together and could interact and live harmoniously and so on. One of the other important things, he translated the Jewish Bible into German, one of his lifelong works. And he was involved with a lot of different people. He dialogued with Albert Einstein and great people and of his own time. I don't know if that gives enough feel for it or not, but
what did he mean about life of dialogue? What would that look like?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah. Well, first of all, let's say it would be an antidote to something we see in today's world, which is depersonalization, of taking the person out of the equation, people being treated like cogs in a machine, or people being manipulated and controlled. The sex trafficking today would be a good example. The other way I think we see a lot of depersonalization today is through the phone. In other words, instead of interacting personally, face-to-face, we often interact, especially young people today, through the phone. In other words, I remember asking a young man to apologize to one of our staff members at Corpus Christi, a student who had offended her. And he assured me he would, and so I found what he texted her.
My bad.
It just floored me. He texted her an apology, and I remember just being like unbelieving. How could this? But I mean, all young people tell me that texting is safer, and you can check things out. It's also more dangerous, because people will text bullying messages, for example. They would never do it face-to-face. I remember one theologian was being criticized, and he challenged the guy. He says, well, it could be a lot worse. if I did it by over the internet. So anyway, it's depersonalization. And I'm thinking, Brad, artificial intelligence, what's that going to mean in terms of personal relationships? So depersonalization is a problem in our, and I could easily say a growing problem with artificial intelligence. And so I'd like to raise up Martin Buber as saying, no, there's another way to interact. So you're onto it. We got to talk about what does a life of dialogue look like.
And it involves, obviously, a more connected approach with everyone, whether it be family, friends, neighbors, the wait staff at a restaurant.
Even nature.
Even nature.
Buddhist thing. Yeah, even nature. So how are we going to get at this, what this looks like? Well, let's try it through his book, I, Thou. So he distinguished two types of relationships, I, Thou, and I, It.
And just for Thou means, it means you. It's a ancient term for...
Yeah, Thou.
Yeah.
Thou, we use it in prayers, we address God as Thou, which is an important part of this because Buber thought that it is in relationships that we find God. So every time we interact with a Thou, another human being in an open way, God is present in that. He's the eternal Thou. That's so this language is complete in life of dialogue. You want to well, who is God in a life of dialogue? It's God is the great Thou, the whole completely present one, the eternal Thou, and we find it in our personal relationships. So when we're on relationships, I think it's important to note that Martin Buber had a strong attachment to Jesus. He called Jesus his brother in faith. He saw him as a great teacher within Judaism, as a great prophet, and his brother he called Jesus. So we got to get this I Thou is it's sort of like a spectrum in personal relationships. In other words, with some person you might be, well, this person I relate to him because he can help me get a job, and so I'm nice to him and cultivate him and all for the purpose of winning him over so he will put in a good recommendation for my job. That's using a person. That's an I-it relationship. In an I-thou relationship, which is the other extreme of how we interact in a relationship, in the I-thou, I'm completely present to the other person. I put aside my own needs. I'm aware of what's going on. I'm crawling behind the eyes of the other person.
Very present.
Yeah, so I can see the other person as they experience life. Yeah, presence is a great word in talking about it. It's to be totally present. It's to be open to what's going on. It's to be able to put aside one's own needs in order to listen to the others. In the conversation, instead of saying, I know what I'm going to tell her after this, next after she stops talking for a while. Then instead of that, of trying to listen to what she's saying and not planning my next brilliant insight or my next brilliant response to what she's saying. So I give you, honey, I give you your chance now. I will try to be present to you. And so at its extreme, we put aside ourselves. We overcome selfishness. We enter into the other person's world. We are a good listener. And that's hard to do, and we almost never do it perfectly. Buber has an interesting story about a young man who came to see him, and Buber had just come off of what I presume was a strong mystical experience, and he was taken with that, and he was in touch with the eternal vow and so on. So the young man comes to him, and if you were an observer, you'd say, wow, Buber's really present to him. You know, he's listening, and he's not interrupting, and he's giving the guy a chance and say. But Buber's interpretation was, I failed in that. You know, as an observer would say, well, you were really great, great listener. No, I wasn't completely present. I didn't sense that this young man was making a life decision. The young man was going off to World War I and died in World War I. Anyway, Buber raises that himself to show how he himself was not present. And he sort of was an experience in his own life where he said, I got to do better at this. I got to be more involved. So the I thou, you can't live there all the time. I mean, you know, you have your, we move, as I say, it seems to me it's like sometimes I'm more present than others, mm-hmm. right? You know that. Sometimes yeah. you're listening and sometimes you're half right. listening, right. sort of listening, pretending to listen and so on. And there's other times when you're empathetic, when you can feel the other's pain or rejoice in the other person's great accomplishment, and it thrills you as much as it does that person that's telling you about it. So the I-it, we're going to live with I-it most of the time, you know, but we, even that we can temper. See, Buber had a good sense of what we in the Catholic tradition call original sin. That is, there's a dark side to us, and then that dark side, we our selfishness takes over, or our neediness, our need takes over, and instead of confirming the other, we are expressing our own needs. I use that word confirm. Let me go back. I like that word because that's an interesting.
That's a term that he used, right? Yeah, confirming
yeah.
others.
Yeah, there was a famous dialogue in 1956 up in Ann Arbor. Between Carl Rogers, great psychotherapist, and Martin Buber. And Carl Rogers' big thing in all human relationships was to accept the other.
Unconditionally.
Yeah, you accept the other person. You don't try to change him or anything else. You accept. That's his big word. And Buber said, well, I think there's something deeper than that. Not just to accept other people, but to confirm them. Mm-hmm. And what he meant was, if you truly love somebody, really care for them, you see their potential. You see what they could become. You can see where, what God has given them, gifts that they could develop and so on. And so that would be confirming. Oh, and so he would say, in all our relationships, we ought to be aware of the other's capabilities, the other's potential. Like, what could she be? I remember a guy did a marriage encounter. That's when husbands and wives go off for a weekend and they write each other notes about things and so on. And going into it, he said about his wife, I can read her like a book. Mm-hmm. And coming out, he told me, he says, you know, she's newly surprising to me.
How's that?
She's now newly surprising to me. There's aspects of her. I've lived with her for 23 years, and I never knew this. I never appreciated it. She has this side. She was a secret baseball fan. No. There was something about her that he didn't see. So she's, I love that phrase, she's newly surprising to me, which could happen in all of our relationships. So confirming others.
That's a powerful, powerful statement. You know, one of the things he also talked about was just finding joy in everyday existence.
Yeah.
Right, the everyday, mundane.
Right.
And part of that is just being alert to those things in other people, but the nature part, what's the relationship part with nature that he advocated?
It's appreciating nature. It's you can have an I-thou relationship with a tree, which is sort of a way of talking about making fun of Buber in a way. You have an I-thou, but that is where we're trying to learn to appreciate nature. I remember seeing the movie The March of the Penguins. I don't know if other people saw that movie or not, but it opened up. I mean, how those penguins, you know, reproduce and how they support one another and how they protect themselves. And they take turns being on the outer rim of the circle, March of the Penguins. So I think a lot of that is, that's not his strong suit, but it's certainly part of what he is about.
Part of it.
You know, I was thinking the other thing that he warns us against is stereotyping others. You know, don't box people in. Mm. You know, there's a lot of emphasis these days in religious circles on the Myers-Briggs or different typologies. When you say, well, so-and-so is a EFPN or something. Or right. All the letters and so on. And I mean, I know that people used that effectively in their ministry to understand the people they were dealing with. Are they introverts? Are they extroverts? A lot of that's based on a typology from Carl Jung, the psychotherapist. And there's something good about that, but Buber was leery of it. You know, just because you say this person's an introvert, maybe you're not letting them be their extrovert self in other situations. So it's a warning, I think, worth thinking about. There are various ways of stereotyping people. And, you know, and we see that in sexism, right? You know, really strongly. Stereotypical language about the sexes that doesn't allow them to be themselves. Men shouldn't cry, you know, but we have to allow for us men to express our emotional life and to right. be sad or to be upset and yeah. to be angry and so on. Avoid stereotyping.
Buber also had some context about married life.
Yeah, tell me what you thought about some of that.
It was... really that freeing aspect with your spouse,
uh-huh.
not trying to control
yeah.
and just allowing them to confirm your spouse. But what I also found interesting was his belief and statement that the romantic feelings, love endures.
Yeah.
There's an enduring aspect of love that outlasts the romantic feelings.
Yeah.
And that's where the depth comes in.
Mm-hmm. Did that ring true?
That
to
rang,
you?
Yes, yes.
As a married man.
As a married man.
How many years you been married?
We've been married 35 years.
Yeah.
I think you were there at that
I
event
was.
On April 16th, 1988.
That's
you
right.
played a big role.
Yes, I presided
you
at
presided.
That wonderful wedding with Laura. Yeah.
I think the other part too is he in the realm of sexuality, he
yeah.
suggested
I know, yeah.
that, I'll just take it from the male standpoint,
yeah.
that you should, we as males, should envision the sexual encounter from
yeah.
the vantage point of your wife.
Yeah.
Now there's, that took it to a different level than that it should be mutual, right?
Yeah.
That took it that it should be really about the other person,
yeah.
not about you. And that was striking to me.
Yeah, I wondered how you would respond to that.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. That's in a book that I wrote called Contemporary Theologians that you read, right?
It was well framed.
And a chapter on Martin Buber.
Yep.
I wondered how you thought about that. I didn't. I wanted to be careful. I didn't pontificate on something I know nothing about.
I think it's if you had a room full of men and just put that out there, that would be a robust conversation.
Yeah.
Because it's, in general, sexuality has been framed more in the male standpoint, right?
Right.
That's a generalization. And
of course, yeah.
When we're better... spouses and men, it's a more mutual.
Yeah.
But I think it takes some work to get there if
mm-hmm.
we're being real honest as men
yeah.
and as husbands. And so then if we're in a room of husbands, we're trying, well, how can we better be unselfish with
mm-hmm.
that piece? And so you just talk about the sexuality, but then it opens up that whole other aspect that Buber talks about, of just being confirming of your spouse and not some shaping the relationship so it better suits us.
Yeah. Yeah, in the relationships, it's one of the things of dialogue that Buber says is that in genuine dialogue, we're searching for a truth that's greater than either one of us possesses now. You know, as a result of dialogue, we both should grow. I should see something that I didn't see before, and so should you. And
but you have to be alert for that to happen. You have to be attentive, right?
Yeah,
not distracted. And
that's right. You got to move more on that spectrum to the I thou, and but that we need more dialogue today. I mean, just how are we gonna, you know, overcome this depersonalization? So what we're gonna do is invite more people to try to reach out to the other person. So we want all of us to set aside our selfishness a little bit. I always thought that one of the great needs, the values or what are the abilities that ministers, priests, leaders, teachers should have is to be able to say, I can put aside my own needs enough, long enough to actually listen and try to respond. And that's a hard thing to do, of course. As Buber says, we always return to I, it. You can't get away from it. That's the life in which we live.
What do you think Buber's ideas as far as rejuvenating kind of the our efforts to personalize things? What are some of the ideas besides just some of the things we've talked about? Is there anything that we haven't covered yet?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. That life of dialogue is such a comprehensive term.
Right.
I suppose the only way to do that is to tear it apart more and to see, you know, what subheadings you might put under that. I think that in today's world, one of the things we have to do is to, young people, the next generation has to figure out, what do you do with the cell phone? You know, what do you do about trying to personally interact with people more and less through text messages and so on? And I think that will be one of the great challenges of the generation that grew up with cell phones and know nothing else. Is that sufficient? I mean, as I see on campus, we're walking around, there's three people walking together, each has their own phone. Each is involved with their own phone and not interacting with one another. I mean, it's...
Can I give you a very recent example of a cell phone experience that kind of deals with the yearning for connection and how the cell phone can interfere it? So I went, just last week, I went with two friends and we saw the classic rock Hall of Famers, The Pretenders, at a very small venue. It's called The Shelter in downtown Detroit. 400 people there. And the Pretenders have been opening for, they're doing an arena tour, but they're playing these small venues just to make connections with their, it's more enjoyable. So we're in there, it's no seats, everyone stands, and an hour and a half of standing, and they come on stage, everyone goes, just really excite the energy in the air. But what happens now when the performer comes on stage is everyone takes their cell phone out and takes pictures or video. So Chrissy Hynde is the lead singer for The Pretenders. And again, she's been performing for 40 years. And I could tell she was really thrown off and even upset by the cell phones being out and as they emerged. And she was waving at people and pointing at people while she was singing. And then she got done with the song. And she said, and I'm cleaning this up, basically, put your phones away and just enjoy the music. And she said, you're messing with my head. And so literally there's 400 of us. Now, fortunately, myself and my two colleagues, we didn't take our phones out because we were enjoying the moment. But I would say half of the people there had their phones out for that.
Yeah.
Most of that first song. and everyone put their phones away. People clapped for that kind of that coaching up and and dressing down. And then about halfway through, Chrissy Hynde says, "I can tell some of you are sneaking pictures. That's okay. I just, you threw me off when I first came out." It was a very authentic.
Oh, man, that's a tremendous story, yeah. Of what, this is what we're dealing with in the contemporary world.
Yes.
So I guess Martin Buber would say, put away your
phone. Put away your phone. Enjoy the moment. Enjoy the music. Enjoy the person across from you.
Yeah. You know, Buber tried to make a philosophy out of all of this. I'm not sure how. But he said things like, in the beginning is relationship. So relationship is everything. He said, it's not like, here I am, this subject, and I'm going to try to figure out how to relate to other people. We are born into relationships. You know, we're present to what is going on. We have to enrich that. I want to go back to something else. He was big on what we call hasidism. It's a mystical movement within Judaism. It goes back to the Baal Shem Tov. I don't think I said that right, Baal Shem Tov, in the 18th century, who was very mystically oriented. And and Buber collected Hasidic tales, put them into a book, and Hasidism. And one of he took the movement away from being a mystical movement so much as being an everyday thing. And that this is, you live, so he tells the story of this individual groups of Hasidic Jews. Leader was called a Tzaddik. The Baal Shem Tov was the major Tzaddik, but each community had its own Tzaddik. So the Hasidic Jews are on the day before Day of Atonement, they're gathered in the synagogue, and the rabbi or the Tzaddik doesn't show up. And so one woman there in the group thought, well, I'll take this opportunity to run home. I left my baby alone. So she runs home to see how her baby's doing. And there's the Tzaddik holding the baby and said, well, I was passing by your house. The baby was crying and I wanted to comfort the baby. So that's an Hasidic tale of being present to opportunities and not passing them by. So he thought it was more important to comfort this crying baby than to be the leader of the 30 people who had gathered for worship and for prayer. Hasidic tales.
Yeah.
And that goes back to putting into practice the life of dialogue in everyday things, in ordinary things. And so we can practice a life of dialogue when we meet a friend who we haven't seen for years, and we at least try to see how she was doing over these last 20 years before I tell her all the brilliant things I've done in the last 20 years. So I think that, in everyday life, there's a chance. How about saying thank you to the woman at the checkout stand in the grocery store? You know, I recently had lunch at my favorite hangout, the Door Street Cafe, and I had lunch with a sister, a Sylvania Franciscan sister. And the waitress was very good and kind. And the waitress told me a few days later, she says, well, that guest of yours wrote me a note thanking me for being such a good waitress. Mm. I thought, wow. And she was telling me about it. She was happy about it. So there's a million chances throughout the day. The husband says, honey, I know you're upset. And I will give you I want to give you your space and time to work this out. I'm ready to talk when you're ready. Instead of saying, we got to get this settled right now.
Yeah.
We got to get this out. He recognizes that she needs time and space to figure out what went on, to see what her reactions are, to get herself more cognizant of the dynamics, then she'll be ready to talk.
Right.
So part of it is, you know, being in tune with other people's rhythm and other people's needs. I mean, sometimes that becomes evident in conversation that start out, we're talking about sports and so on, and our favorite teams, and then suddenly the person said, you know what, I got to tell you what happened the other night with my dog, who's not doing well. At that point, the conversation has to move away from sports to the dog, to what was happening with the dog, because now I sense the person wants to talk about this. They need to talk about it. It's bothering them and so on. So the Hasidic movement for Buber attuned him to not the mystical experience, not the kind of experience he had before he talked with the young man who died in World War I, but ordinary experiences, daily experiences where we meet the other. And now to get back to that most fundamental point, so in those examples, Buber said, there's always the eternal thou there. That we don't know God directly, but how do we know God? We know directly in being attentive to this person who needs to talk about their needs right now. When I'm attentive to that, I'm encountering God.
Yeah.
I'm encountering the eternal thou. And this is really the only way, for Buber, that's the only way I'm going to find God, is in personal relationships and improving them, deepening them, and confirming the other.
Yeah. Well, many aspects of Buber's life and theology are instructive to us, and this has been a great conversation, and thanks for highlighting some of those really powerful aspects of Martin Buber.
Yeah, people might want to take up his classic work, I, Thou, and read it and see what they get out of it.
It'll be a great read.
Yeah.
Thank you, Davey.